I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. This week, we reflect on what's happened in Baltimore in the 2 years since the violence and uprising sparked by the death of Freddie Gray while in the custody of police. Even before the National Guard troops had left town in April of 2015, civic leaders and community activists identified systemic racial and economic inequality as root causes for the unrest. The road forward they envisioned included more employment and educational opportunities for people in some of our city's most distressed neighborhoods. Well, has that happened? My guest today is Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, the president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. An acclaimed educator and mentor, Dr. Hrabowski has a unique perspective when it comes to nurturing the talents of students of color. We'll talk about the issues that were brought to light by the unrest in 2015 and the keys to empowering youth in our city. Midday starts right after the news. And good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you've joined us for today's edition of Midday. Thursday marks the second anniversary of what has come to be known as the Uprising, the violence that tore through the city following the funeral of Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old African-American man who suffered a fatal spinal injury while being arrested by Baltimore City Police. The six officers who were involved in that arrest were indicted a few days later. National Guard troops came and went. Politicians, business leaders, education professionals, and community activists weighed in on why the unrest happened and what should and could be done to prevent it from ever happening again. Baltimore became part of the national conversation about police misconduct and distrust between police and communities of color. None of the six officers indicted in the death of Freddie Gray were convicted of a crime. After a Department of Justice report slammed Baltimore police for pattern and practice of unconstitutional behavior, a consent decree signed in the waning days of the Obama administration was agreed to. The process of implementing that decree continues under the eye of a federal judge. The CVS pharmacy that so famously burned to the ground on national television during the unrest has been rebuilt. So has the Mary Harvin Senior Center, which was half-built when it was burned down on the city's east side. Many of the nearly 400 businesses damaged during the violence have reopened. Some have not. The long-term economic impact of this difficult chapter in our city's history remains to be seen, but restaurants, arts organizations, colleges, and hotels all reported a significant decrease in activities in the months following April 2015. Baltimore police have instituted several changes in policing methods, including body cameras and cameras in vans like the one Freddie Gray rode in. Crime in 2015 and 2016 was at levels not seen for many years. The homicide rate in Baltimore for this year is tragically on pace to be equally as horrific. So what has changed since that spring in neighborhoods like Sandtown Winchester, which found itself at the epicenter of the violence? There was at the time much talk about the lack of job opportunities, education, and access to health care. Promises were made to address the longstanding problems of racial and economic inequality that undergirded the uprising. Were any of those promises kept? Well, today and again on Wednesday and Thursday here on Midday, we will take up the questions of where we've been and where we need to go as a city with activists and community leaders. My guest for this hour is Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, a national leader in education and civil rights. He has been the president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County for 25 years and has transformed it into an internationally acclaimed research and teaching institution. His most recent book is Holding Fast to Dreams, Empowering Youth from the Civil Rights Crusade to STEM Achievement. In 2012, he was asked by President Obama to chair the President's Advisory Commission on Educational Excellence for African Americans. And if I listed all of the awards and accolades that he has received, we would fill the entire hour. So I will eschew that and simply welcome Dr. Freeman Hrabowski to Midday. It's great to see you, sir.
Thank you, Tom. Delighted to be here.
Great to have you. You know, your perch when it comes to civil rights, when it comes to education, it's not done from a distance. You were part of the Children's Crusade in Birmingham, Alabama, when you were a kid. You were jailed in the same jail in Birmingham, Alabama, that Dr. King was jailed in the month after he wrote the letter from a Birmingham jail. You have lived this stuff. I wonder, 2 years hence, do you think that the moment in Ferguson – Missouri in 2014, which gave rise to the Black Lives Matter movement, the moment here in Baltimore in 2015, and the moments that have taken place in many other cities across the country, are seminal moments, are pivotal moments in the way that 1963, 1964, with the Civil Rights Act, 1965, with the Voting Rights Act, were where you grew up as a child and across the country then.
There's no doubt that this period is pivotal in our country for many reasons, just as the 60s could be considered just that same type of point. The point is that a lot of light began to shine on the challenges that we face as a nation at that time in Birmingham, but many other places at this time in St. Louis, in Baltimore, but around the country. When I always say around the nation is these are American problems, issues, whether in urban areas or rural areas, there are many challenges that we face. At the heart of those challenges will be inequality. Whether talking about the income challenges that we face, the academic achievement issues, the health disparities, the gaps that exist between those of us who are fortunate to have gotten an education and those people who have not. And similarly, during that period in the 60s, race was at the heart of it. And today, in many ways, race still is, because disproportionately large numbers of people from undereducated communities are minorities. But I would also add that people who are from low-income backgrounds of all races face many challenges, just as do blacks and Hispanics.
What has changed fundamentally? I mean, President Obama was sometimes criticized by members of the African-American community for not acknowledging the continuing difficulties and the continuing existence of racial inequality in the United States. He was, by some accounts, too quick to say, look at all the progress we've made, but there's still more to be done. I mean, from your perspective, what has actually improved since 1960 or 1965, and here we are in 2017. There are some things that are kind of obvious, but I wonder, in a fundamental way, has America grappled with racial inequality in a way that really is going to move the ball forward in a significant way?
You know, my students and I talk about these issues, colleagues and students and I, all the time. Race is still an important issue, a challenge we face in our country in many ways. Race relations. People see things very differently depending on where you're sitting. And the fact is, when I think about where we were in the 60s and today, there are some changes. There's progress. I could not have been president of a UMBC, obviously, in the 60s, and could not have sat in classroom with white kids in my city in high school. So there are ways in which the situation has changed. Now, for many people in the middle of hypersegregation, for example, you still find that children are with people only from their own backgrounds. And so there are still those issues that we face. What I would say is this. In the 60s, we went through those marches. We had legislation, and it wasn't just the Voting Rights Act, but it was also the Higher Education Act. What most people don't realize was that only 10% of Americans in 1965 had completed college. Literally, only about 2-3% of blacks and about 11% of whites. Now, you didn't have to have a college education to get a decent job. Bethlehem Steel, or in my town, Stockton Valve and Fittings. Today, we know we need more and more higher education. And we've made tremendous progress. 30% of Americans have now completed college, with about 20% of blacks, about 37% of whites. The fastest growing group, Hispanics, is only 15%. Native Americans below that. The Asian population is slightly higher. It's about 50%. But the fact is, 2/3 of American families still have no one who's graduated from college at a time when we need more people with 2- and 4-year degrees than ever. If a person is able to get an education, can read well and think well and has some skills, that person can get a job and take care of his or her family. Will that person experience some discrimination? In many cases, yes. Yes, there's no doubt. Just as we've made progress with women, but there are still ways in which women are not given their fair due. It's very clear when looking at income levels, when looking at jobs that they have and the amount of money that's associated with those jobs. So we've made progress. There's much more progress to be made, is what I would say.
And I think it will come as a shock to a lot of folks to hear a statistic like two-thirds of American families.
Right.
Two-thirds.
Yes.
Most
yes.
people
yes, still.
Don't have a person in college.
That's exactly right. Who graduate. And there's a difference. You see, here's the point. Years ago, when people went to college, they tended to graduate. Today, only about half the people who go to college actually graduate with degrees from 2 or 4 year degrees. In fact, when I ask American audiences how many are over 45, I can tell those people that they are second in the world as the best educated, literally, behind only one country. But if you are between 25 and 34, you're number 12 in the world because other countries have been sending more people to college and they graduate. Our challenge is that large numbers don't graduate. And at the heart of the matter, start this way, the bottom quarter in our society, income-wise, will have about a 10% chance today of graduating from college without some major intervention. So in the 60s, it was that way. Today, it's still that way.
And income level is still then, it seems, the sort of major, the main indicator of success in college. I mean, if half of the people who are starting college can't finish,
right.
and some of them are not finishing because they can't afford it,
right.
others are not finishing because they maybe can't handle it academically. I mean, I'm sure there's a whole panoply of reasons.
And I would, when we talk about it, it's very important to unpack that notion of can't handle it academically. The fact is they didn't get the strong reading and thinking skills. They did not go to a school that gave them that level of support, you see. If a child learns, as a mathematician, I can tell you, if a child learns to read and think well, we can teach her to solve math word problems. Whether it's chemistry, physics, engineering, those are word problems. So language skills, reading and thinking are at the heart of success in any society.
And this is something that you have taken the bull by the horns with at UMBC.
Yes.
You have a program called the Meyerhoff Scholars Program that you instituted back in the 80s.
Yes.
And
yes.
you're identifying people perhaps that didn't have the sort of all of the accoutrements of a top flight education, from K through 12.
Right.
But you're bringing them to UMBC and you're helping them succeed.
Well, I'll say very quickly, and Bob Meyerhoff was very visionary in thinking about African-American males to start with, and then students in general. And now the program has perhaps 60%+ minorities, and then students of all races. Those students really are the best in their schools. Let me say that. The difference is that the quality of education in different schools will vary widely depending on the school system and the particular school and the classes the student has taken. But that program leads the country in producing African Americans who go on to get MD PhDs by a factor of 2 to 1. But we have other programs that are, I think, in many ways even more germane right now. When you think about the Sherman Scholars Program at UMBC for math and science teachers, future math and science teachers who will work in challenging schools in Baltimore City often. This is started by George and Betsy Sherman, and it is powerful story of Betsy Sherman being the only white teacher in an inner city school in Virginia 40 some years ago. And she saw that teachers of any race could help children of any race to succeed. And so this program is designed to take math majors and science majors and to get them excited about becoming teachers, which is a part of the challenge we face in our society, to get as many high achievers in different disciplines to enter that noble profession of teaching.
One of the great icons of the civil rights movement, Bob Moses.
Yes.
Started, a person with whom you are quite familiar.
Sure.
Started a thing called the Algebra
That's
Project
right.
nationally.
Yes.
It's a very thriving, a chapter of
sure.
it or whatever here in
sure.
Baltimore.
Sure.
How do we get things like the Algebra Project, mm-hmm. not just, sporadically
yes.
placed around cities
yes.
like Baltimore, neighborhoods
yes.
like Sandtown
right.
or on the east side.
Yes.
How do we get those programs? What is our next step? What mm-hmm. should our next step be in a neighborhood like Sandtown, Winchester, given, what they went through 2 years ago
sure.
and frankly what they went through in the 1960s
sure.
and the problems that hadn't been addressed from then until now?
Right. Let me say several things. I think it's about mindset of all of us. I mean, first of all, we have the tendency to think about leaders and one person, whether it's Martin Luther King or President Obama, who I think did quite a job in so many ways. So I'm very proud of the work that he did. But here's what I would say. we tend to think that most people can't do math and science, on the one hand. On the other hand, we say all children can learn, but our actions don't say we are doing what we need to do to make sure all children learn to read, to think. And so what we're doing at UMBC is focusing on particular schools right now, for example, Lakeland Elementary School, and then Ben Franklin High School. And we have dozens of math majors, for example, working with those children, with those wonderful teachers and the principal to partner to make sure they get the skills they need, because our goal is to make sure that one day they can come to UMBC. And that's a high order. That's a major standard we're talking about. We're talking about students who do well, not just in grades, but on standardized tests, because standardized tests are important, whether people like it or not. You cannot become a physician if you don't pass the test. You can't pass the bar if you don't, you know, we can go on and on and on. So we're working with our faculty and our students, but also with companies like Northrop Grumman, multi-million-dollar initiatives. Now, that's a school, Lakeland Elementary, Ben Franklin. But what we're working to do is to learn things that can help us to help many more schools. And the superintendent's been there with us. I mean, she understands the issues quite well. She's a great leader. And what I would say is we need to bring the kind of gravitas to these initiatives that will focus on analytical skills necessary to help children to read critically, to solve math problems, and to give them the mindset that says, I can do anything. We call the Lakeland Center is a STEAM center because we brought the arts into that work. And all the things we're doing in the city, you'll see us focusing in the arts, humanities, as well as the math and science.
Spoken like a wonderful mathematician and scientist who's also a very good piano player. All right, Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, speaking of gravitas, there is no shortage of it here in Studio A because Dr. Freeman Hrabowski is our guest for the hour. He's the president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. We will have more with Dr. Hrabowski after a break. You are welcome to join our conversation. 410-662-8780 is the number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up on the program tomorrow, I'm going to speak with veteran journalist and former NPR correspondent Barbara Bradley Haggerty about her latest book, Life Reimagined: The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. It's a rumination on the challenges and joys of the years between your 40s and your 60s. So if that's you, or if it's going to be you, or if it used to be you, we hope you will tune in tomorrow to hear what Barb has found out about it. Life Reimagined, tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Dr. Freeman Hrabowski. He's the president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and the author of Holding Fast to Dreams, Empowering Youth from the Civil Rights Crusade to STEM Achievement. In 2012, he was asked by President Obama to chair the President's Advisory Commission on Educational Excellence for African Americans, and he has long been counted among our nation's most imaginative and important leaders. You are welcome to join our conversation with Freeman Hrabowski. Our number here at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. By the way, speaking of the commission that President Obama appointed you to, the Advisory Commission on Educational Excellence for African Americans,
yes,
does that commission still exist in the Trump administration?
Well, it does exist. It's not in operation right now, but it does exist by law at this point. The Hispanic Commission is headed by my friend Eduardo Pardo in Miami, for example. The Asian Commission still exists. There's an HBCU Commission. So they are in existence, and we will see as time goes on how things go.
One of the things that some folks pointed to when the unrest happened in April of 2015 is that there is, in the minds of some folks, this huge disconnect between the city,
yes,
and the, you know, the contiguous counties. I mean, your perch is from Catonsville,
right?
Which,
yes,
you know, for those of us who live downtown,
right,
you know, I live in
Rustboro
Hill. That right. Seems like I need to take my passport out there. You know, I mean, it seems like a long way away to a city kid like me. So, but it really, the solutions here,
yes,
are going to be regional. They're not going to be concentrated in the city of Baltimore.
That is exactly right. That's why I was delighted to see our mayor having Jim Smith, who was over county executive, and to see our current county executive, very concerned about the region itself. The, you know, when my students say they're from Baltimore, they may have come from Poly or from Dulaney Valley High School. They don't, younger people don't think city versus county. We've got to get away from that notion. It's a political jurisdiction issue, I understand. But when you're standing on the roof of the administration building at UMBC, you look at the best view of downtown Baltimore, the skyline ever, anywhere. And when people come from California thinking about moving into our research park, I say, there's our downtown. You know, this is Baltimore, and there's our downtown. Nobody cares that you got words like city and county there. And for my campus, what I say to people all the time is, it'd be easy to stay out in our 600 acres and be in this pastoral setting, but the real deal is we must be as concerned about the city as anyone. We must be. And so during that time of Freddie Gray, my students put up big signs, these wonderful signs all over saying, we are Baltimore too. You know, they were connected. And because of our choice program for first-time offenders, we were very involved throughout that period in helping to keep those children safe. We had been working even before Freddie Gray between our families of these first-time offenders, hundreds and hundreds, and the parents and mothers, grandmothers, and, quite frankly, the police, to build relationships. And it was particularly significant that during that period, we had built some of those relationships through art expression and restorative circles. And so we were very connected throughout that period with students who were from Baltimore City, those who lived there, but thinking about this issue, this challenge of uprising as something we all should be connected to and understanding with layers. And so when we had town hall meetings, for example, at UMBC, it was to understand, how did we get here? What's the history? What's the context here? What can we learn from this? What role should we be playing? And if you look at some of my graduates, you see they are some of the leaders in our city, from Joe Jones with the Center for Urban Fathers and Families to Alicia Wilson, who's over community relations now, vice president at Sagamore, to Diane Bell McCoy, who's with Associated Black Charities, to the head of the Greater Ball Committee, Stephanie Hill. I mean, I can go on and on. Adrian Jones, Speaker Pro Tem in the county, but for the whole state, and very involved in the city. These are people who care about Baltimore, about the issues. And for me, at the heart of the issues will be our children, education, health disparities, but jobs and safety. Those are the issues we all talk about.
And as Baltimore, the city of Baltimore, that political jurisdiction rises and falls, so do the fortunes of the things that are connected to Baltimore as closely as Baltimore County, Anne Arundel County, Howard
that
County.
That is exactly
right.
I mean,
I can guess. I haven't talked to you about this, but I would imagine you fielded quite a few fearful phone calls in April of 2015 from parents who were saying, my kid is how far away from all of this?
Right. I mean, people
want to know. Or in 2016, if I'm going to come to UMBC, how close am I going to be to all that?
Yes.
I mean, folks from colleges have told me that their admissions, you know, definitely took a hit.
Yes.
You know, where do they stand in UMBC?
Actually, we're bursting at the seams, to be perfectly honest with you. And we talk about the fact that our students learn how to be leaders in the region, including in the city. But people who come from New York, people who come from cities, are accustomed to the challenges of cities. And we do have our challenges. We should never sugarcoat that. We know we have to work on this safety issue. We've got to work to help children learn to read. So these are challenges that we face. At the same time, we're one of the best educated cities in the country. And so the question becomes, how can you be, on the one hand, a college town with over 100,000 students, all right? On the other hand, a place where we've got to help children learn to read well. And what I would say is, it's an American issue. We see these same problems all over. And so as goes Baltimore, as goes St. Louis and these places, so will go America. We have to think that way, that it's not just about our city or even just about our region. These are American challenges that the leaders and all citizens should be concerned about.
And so does that mean that Mr. Kamenetz, Mr. Kittleman, the leaders of the contiguous counties around the city of Baltimore with Mayor Pugh, what is their responsibility? What is their opportunity for fixing what ails us here in the city?
No, I think it's great responsibility, but I think we as citizens have to work and support them. I do think that these leaders are concerned about those issues and understand the connectedness of the region. But most important, I want to say to citizens that we all have a responsibility. What we're working to teach our students, our faculty and colleagues are working to teach our students, is we all have to get involved. not about one person or three or four people. It's about all of us. You know, there's a Baltimore Collegiate School for Boys in the city of Baltimore. Well, the founding parent is one of my distinguished faculty members. She actually does things here on this radio program, Kimberly Moffitt.
Kimberly Moffitt.
You know, I mean, it's wonderful because we've got their dean of students is one of my graduates, and others are teaching there, and we bring those boys to campus. What we have to do is knock down the boundaries between the different sectors, between universities and schools, between cities and counties, and connect in ways that can help our children and support our teachers in this work.
Dr. Freeman Raske, he's our guest this afternoon on Midday, 410-662-8780, midday at WIPR.org. If you want to drop us an email, if you want to send us a tweet, our handle is at Midday Tom Hall. The phones are blowing up. No surprise there. Soraya in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Hrabowski.
Hi, it's Soraya.
Soraya.
Yeah.
My apologies. Welcome to the show.
You're good. My question is mostly, I'm a person with learning disabilities. I have dyslexia, dyscalculia, you name it, I have it all. And I found out about all these pretty late in my life. And I've been through three colleges and basically failed out of all of them. My question is, like, what are schools doing nowadays to help out people like me, achieve the best of our abilities? Because in high school, I had a 3.5, and in college, I had a 1.5.
Well, that's a great question, and thank you so much for sharing that with us, Soraya.
It's a great question. I think the important point about success of students is that that universities have to know their students. They have to look at their strengths and the challenges students face and determine what resources are necessary to help that student succeed. And so the key, Soraya, is that we need to find ways of understanding what the person has as an interest. For example, in your case, what you're interested in majoring in, what your particular challenges, learning challenges are, and which university in the area has specializations in that. Different universities specialize in helping people with different challenges. And so when you ask the questions of people, you can ask them about the services they offer at a UMBC, but the services that may be offered at a Towson, for example. They have some very strong programs in learning disabilities, more so than we do, though we have students with different kinds of challenges. Challenges at UMBC also. It's about the specificity of the challenges that the student faces. Mm-hmm. I would say ask those questions of admissions about each of the campuses and ask what's been your experience and your success rate with people with my particular challenges.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, Soraya. Much appreciated. Andre in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski.
Hey, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a 4-year-old. And I just want to know what links, websites, programs I can get him started in to support his trajectory into, you know, academic success.
Sure.
And he's an African-American child.
Okay. I probably would sound self-serving if I said, get my book on raising smart boys. But I don't get any of the royalties, so I can say that to you on
It's called Beating the Odds, yeah. Raising Academically Successful African-American Males.
Yeah. Yes,
Dr. Browski literally did write the book on that subject.
But I don't get any of the royalties, so I'm not being self-serving. It all goes to the university. But, Andre, there's several things I would say that are in the book based on listening to parents of children at a very early age. You want to be Legos, for example, really important. The puzzles and Legos go. You can go to even toy stores or wherever and ask for things for children between 3 and 5, 3 and 6. But Legos, I have found always, every parent has told me about how important those Legos can be in giving the child a chance to use his curiosity and putting things together and having some success. The other thing I would say is reading to that child. Really important. And letting the child with picture books, you go into any of the stores and they will have things for children your age for in terms of books. And then there's software, again, and little toys that will focus on helping the child encourage that child's curiosity. Keep getting the child to be as curious and ask as many questions. But language skills are very important. Encourage the child to tell stories and to look at books and to look at the software. If you go into any store for children, you will see stuff there for kids between those ages. Very, very important. Nothing takes the place, though, than letting that child know that he can do anything if he just works hard and works with you and you keep giving him that support. It's the sense of self that every child of every race needs.
Well, thank you for your call, Andre, and certainly do like your instincts as a dad.
Yeah,
so,
it's great.
God bless and good luck
with your He's so fortunate to have you in his life asking those questions right now, Andre.
Indeed he is. Julie in Kingsville, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Hi. Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
My question is about that scholarship program that you mentioned.
Yes.
I'm a former science teacher, uh-huh. and I no longer teach. And I was wondering how you are dealing with the retention rate of those talented mathematicians and scientists who usually leave the teaching profession after they've done their time to pay off their scholarship because right. of the lack of ability to move forward and make more money.
Right. There's several things I would say. Number one, we don't require them to teach, but it is an honor, we think, for them to teach. And we do give them support after they have graduated and are teaching, and we build a community among the Sherman Scholars. But we do the same thing in other programs we have for the Sondheim Scholars, for the Linehan Artist Scholars, in all these, and for the Sewitt Scholars, for the women in IT. We believe, as I say in my book in STEM Achievement, that whether it's in STEM or in the humanities, in the arts, that building community among people, whether they're still in college or they're now young professionals, can help give them the support they need to figure out how to succeed in the work and to remain in that work. But I would also argue for teachers that we need ways of giving them opportunities to make money in the summertime, to have connections with things that can be related to that which they teach, but also to make some additional money. I mean, you're absolutely right. We should never suggest that money is not important. People have to pay their mortgage. That's just real. They have to send their kids to college or to school. You know, so I would add that what we work to do is to get people all kinds of opportunities to add to the money they're making, especially in the summertime, in terms of working in companies or other teaching opportunities to supplement the money they're making. And the salaries are getting better and better. They are. They are not where they need to be, I would agree.
Well, thank you for your call, Julie. I appreciate it. You know, teaching is hard.
Yes.
Teaching is
yes.
a tough gig.
Yes.
It's a really tough gig.
Yes.
And, you know, I think of a woman I met about 8 months ago. The Community Foundation
yes.
was doing a series of focus groups.
Yes.
And they asked me to be part of this
yes.
group. There were people from all over town. And there was a lady there who does an after-school drop-in program uh-huh. in Park Heights,
yes.
Northwest Baltimore.
Yeah.
And they were talking about, you know, grant programs that might be available and what the money would go for and how these smaller organizations, you know, many of them sort of run, you know, on a shoestring
yes.
budget, would profit from investment by mm-hmm. People who are affiliated with the Community Foundation. And she said a very revelatory thing to me. She said, I've been doing this for 20 years.
Right.
We have the kids come over and they drop in after school.
Right.
And I say to these young men
yes.
in particular, you can play video games, you can play ping pong, you mm-hmm. can fool around and mess around after you've done your homework.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, my biggest problem is getting these young guys mm-hmm. to do the homework.
Yes. Yes.
So that's my biggest problem.
Sure.
She said, is there a grant program for
right.
that?
Right.
You know?
Right.
I mean, this is a real life, you know, Monday,
yes.
Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday problem
sure.
for this lady.
Sure.
What would you say to her
sure.
as a piece of advice?
Great question. Number one, building trust between children and adults. I do think we need opportunities for males and females from colleges to work with young people, whether they're in the third grade or they're in the 10th grade, because young kids and teenagers will relate more easily to college students, for example. And so whether we're in our Breaking Ground program for community engagement, where we've got scores of courses connected to working with children and community groups, from engineering to humanities to the arts, that the emphasis is on building relationships between the students at the university and children. It's very important. It helps both in many ways. It teaches my college students that these kids can do anything. It teaches the children they can be like these college students. But I will tell you, having worked in math and math education for over 40 years, when I'm in a school at Lakeland, for example, and we're looking at fourth grade questions on the test, and we're working to help children grasp the concept and solve the problem and answer the question easily, it's challenging work, far more challenging than people. Because, first of all, people learn in different ways. Secondly, at different time at different paces. For example, you do have to build
boys different than
boys
girls.
Boys different from girls. They can be bored with the work, and you've got all these factors going on. I told you we have 20 some majors, math majors, working helping teachers in Lakeland right now. And as I talk to the young students who are working with them and have these circles, same way I did in civil rights years ago, I am amazed at the questions my college students will ask about the challenges they're facing with the children, whether the child trusts the college student in the answer he's giving or in the way he's approaching it, for example, or the kid who's bored and doesn't want to be connected. But most important, people don't realize that to explain a concept with clarity, one must understand it from different perspectives and be able to use different language at different points to get the point across and to ask questions of a child that will have that child having that aha moment. And it takes far more, again, gravitas than we realize for a third or fourth grade child, let alone for somebody teaching calculus.
Yeah, and teaching calculus and this whole notion of compensation and, you know, how we value teachers in a society.
Sure. You'd appreciate the STEAM work we're doing now involving the arts with math and
STEAM,
science.
That's science, technology, engineering, arts.
Yeah. The arts are very important in helping us with creativity and in getting the students to connect. And so we've got people from Northrop Grumman, for example, coming over and dealing with audiovisual materials and with engineering in music, for example. And we've got people in the visual arts at UMBC working at Station North, bringing the arts into that work. And again, it's never easy. It does take analysis and careful thought and authenticity. Children can tell when they really can't trust you or when you're not really there mentally, emotionally, intellectually.
True that. Yeah. After a break, we'll have more with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski. He's the president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. This Sunday afternoon, by the way, Dr. Hrabowski will be appearing with Baltimore City Public Schools CEO Sonia Sondalisis in a conversation with attorney Ron Shapiro. That event is entitled Education at a Crossroads, and it's part of a series of events at Beth Am Synagogue in Reservoir Hill. It starts at 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. We've got a link to details on our website, WIPR.org/midday. When we come back from a break, you are welcome to join us with Dr. Hrabowski. Our number here at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Before we take that break, on Mondays, regardless of whatever topic we're tackling, it is our practice here on Midday to read the names of the people who have fallen victim to violence in our city during the previous week. We do so in sympathy and solidarity with their families and friends. So far this year, 98 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Last week, 7 people were the victims of homicide in the city. They are Philip Bradford, age 57. Michael Wise Jr., age 25. Mario Jones, age 28. Shahida Barnes, age 28. Raminico Roland, age 39. Devante Wilson, age 25. And Lavander Edwards, who was 17 years old. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, this reminder about a special event that we've got planned for Friday. We'll be broadcasting midday in front of a live audience from the Stavros Niarchos Foundation Parkway. That's the new home of the Maryland Film Festival. You are welcome to join us for that special broadcast and to get a sneak peek at the Parkway before it opens officially for the Maryland Film Festival next week. Tickets are free, but you need to reserve them, and they are going very fast. It was sold out earlier today, but it's now they have opened up a few more slots. So if you're interested in coming, go to the website, WYPR.org, you'll see a place to click for a link for more of the details. If you have just joined us today, my guest is Dr. Freeman Hrabowski. He has been the president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County since 1992. He's the author of, among other books, Holding Fast to Dreams, Empowering Youth from the Civil Rights Crusade to STEM Achievement. Today is the first of 3 days this week that we are thinking about where Baltimore stands 2 years after the death of Freddie Gray while in police custody and the violence and uprising that took place afterwards. We'll devote Wednesday and Thursday's show to this topic as well, and I'll have more on who our panelists for those shows will be tomorrow. You are welcome to join our conversation today, 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle at midday. Tom Hall. Let's jump back to the phones. Susan in Elkridge, thanks for your call to Midday. You're on the air with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski.
Hello, Dr. Hrabowski. I'm a graduate of UMBC. Thank you very much. Fantastic education.
Thank you.
I appreciate
you.
It. My husband.
I will pay you later. Thank you very much.
I highly recommend UMBC.
Thank you.
I have great concerns about the amount of potential that's being wasted.
Yes.
As a result of students being unable to afford college.
Yes.
Or they're faced with exorbitant student debt.
Yes.
And it seems to me that the financial burden not only hurts the individual, but it's also hurting our states and our country. It's
yes.
a lot of untapped potential.
Yes.
I don't think, from everything I've read and understand, that these blue-collar jobs are ever going to return to what they were decades ago during
right.
my father's time,
yes.
Either in terms of quantity or what they're going to provide in terms of quality of life. We're just not seeing it.
Yes.
And it seems to me that's a call for more students to attend college. So here's what I would love to hear from you.
Uh-huh.
Always respect your opinion.
Uh-huh.
What do you think about Bernie Sanders' idea of providing taxpayer-funded 2- and 4-year state college educations to state residents? We're seeing something like this happening in New York right now, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
Right. I think more and more we will see states looking at ways of helping college to be affordable to people. I think New York's approach is a very reasonable one. If you want more people to have an education and to be able to contribute to the economy, you've got to make sure they can afford it. You're absolutely right. Tennessee has done that at the 2-year level, for example. I would say several things that most people don't realize, that half of Americans now, almost half, begin in community colleges, and there are many jobs available for people who get the training through the 2-year institutions. Now, many may go on and get that 4-year degree, but there are a lot of jobs that require the 2-year training now. In fact, we have a number of certificate programs in our training company out in Howard County that's working with people from the city and other places, and those are for certificates in technology areas for people who have no background in technology. I mean, there are a lot of jobs available. In our research park, we have a number of students who don't have college degrees who are working in biotechnology, in technology jobs. You'd think they were PhDs, and yet they don't have a college degree. So there are many skills that can be acquired that can lead to really good jobs. In addition to that, our Choice Jobs program starts with partnerships with University of Baltimore Law School right now, involving their cafe there and teaching them some basic skills, but it gets them a job, gets them started, all the way to the work. We have a partnership with Starbucks, getting them involved in those jobs. You start somewhere. It doesn't mean you stop there, but you got opportunities there and you can get some training. We need to be working to give people the training they need and the support on the one hand. The one thing that people don't know is that if students are from a low-income background, there's a lot of federal money available. The big problem is people don't apply by the deadline. For example, we say to our students, deadline by Valentine, because the deadline is really March 1. Well, large numbers of kids in the city will be in June talking about needing money for college when the deadline was months before, and there's money that goes unused, quite frankly. So we have to have creative ways of getting more students to apply by the deadline for those from low-income families. Now, for the challenge, as she was just saying, for working-class people who may not be at that poverty line, they still need more support. They need more financial support, and we do need programs of the type she was talking about. In addition to one thing we're doing, we have large numbers of our students working in jobs related to their majors while they're in college. They can pay for that education. There are a lot of internships, paid internships, that can help students pay for their education.
So there is this middle ground.
There is middle ground.
There's not this, you know, the state, you know, completely funding everybody's education.
No, no. We can get a combination.
There is money available.
A lot of federal money.
Not even being taken advantage of.
And some places, what they will do to my graduate is to take the combination of the money you can get from the federal financial aid. What's the gap? And then the state can look at ways of supplementing that. We need to be using that as much as possible.
I want to talk about a lawsuit that you've been involved in, having to do with HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. You are a graduate. Your undergraduate degree was at an HBCU.
My beloved Hampton,
your beloved Hampton. And you have testified in a trial in 2013.
Yes.
It was found the state of Maryland was doing unconstitutional things in terms of discriminating against historically black colleges and universities here in Maryland. There is a tension, it seems. And since then, there's been this remediation period where folks are supposed to be sitting down and figuring this out, what programs are housed in what place. It's complicated.
Yes.
It's not done yet.
Right.
It looks like it may not be done until the summer or something. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. You know a little bit more about it. You testified just, you know, a month or two ago.
Yes.
How do we work out this this apparent disagreement between which programs should be housed where? For example, engineering. You've got a big engineering program at UBC. There's an engineering program at Morgan. Dr. Wilson from Morgan thinks that more of the programs that are housed with you should be housed with them. This is complicated, and your feelings about it, I would imagine, are pretty complex as well, given your own personal history.
Yeah, but I speak with what I call authenticity. I'm going to tell you what I really think. Now, I can't say so much because we're in the middle of this case. I will say that I have great respect for the president of Morgan. We're fellow Alabamians, and he's doing a fine job, and that my wife and I give support to both Morgan and Coppin because of ties to those places, financial support. Now, with that said, I will tell you this. As president of UMBC, I can say my colleagues and I have no desire to give up any program that we have. We need as many programs in these areas as we can get. We are delighted for Morgan to have any program that we have, quite frankly. And the question was about...
But it's not an either-or.
Because
it's
in addition to. It's the genius of the and versus the tyranny of the or, according to Jim Collins. And the idea is this. There are tens of thousands of jobs going unfilled in the state of Maryland right now. No one institution can meet all those needs. We need Morgan producing as many graduates as possible, UMBC, UB, Towson, all of our places, we do. So it would not make sense to us to give up a program. The idea that they would have an additional program is perfectly okay. There's enough room in this space for all of us. It, from our perspective, it is a notion from the 80s, the 20th century, that says one campus has one program, another, when we know we need as many people prepared in these disciplines as possible. So our point is we've got thousands of students wanting these programs. They are residents of the state of Maryland, and they want these programs. It is our intention to continue doing it as much as we can.
You say in your book, Holding Fast to Dreams, that one of the keys to success for students of color is a sense of community.
Yes.
HBCUs can offer a sense of community that other institutions, PWIs, primarily white institutions like the one you head, although you have a very diverse campus.
Yes.
But there is a sense of community that can be had at an HBCU that can't be had at other places.
Who told you that?
Well, you know, I mean, the folks who run HBCUs, for one.
But I tell you what, you come, and I am a very proud graduate of an HBCU. You come and talk to my students of all races. I love saying that we can give students the kind of experience I had in Hampton in our multicultural setting, a place with students from 100 countries. President of student government last year was an African-American, for example, and he would say to you very easily that he's had a great experience. But if you talk to my students of all races, we appreciate the fact that we are building community among those students. We're teaching them to work with people from all kinds of backgrounds, from all races, and we believe we represent what America is supposed to be. Let me just say that perfectly clear, that I have great respect for the HBCUs. They have about 15% of African-American families' kids are there, and they do a remarkable job. Let's start there, all right? So nothing disparaging about those institutions, but UMBC was the first campus in the state of Maryland founded at such a time that students of all races could come there. Every other institution was founded either for blacks or whites. Now, we have fought hard in our country to create a space where people from all backgrounds can be there. We are one of those spaces now. And the fact is, we are about 50% white and 50% of color.
We have so much more to talk about, but we don't have any more time to do it.
Oh, my goodness.
But so grateful to you for your time
this
afternoon.
Thank
Great
you.
To see you.
Come visit UMBC.
I will. I promise. Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, he's the president of UMBC and the co-author of Beating the Odds and Overcoming the Odds, and the author of Holding Fast to Dreams, Empowering Youth from the Civil Rights Crusade to STEM Achievement. He's going to be speaking at Beth Om Synagogue in Reservoir Hill on Sunday afternoon. The presentation's entitled Education at a Crossroads. Dr. Hrabowski will be with Baltimore City Public Schools CEO Sonia Santelises, and they'll be in conversation with Ron Shapiro. That event starts at 3 o'clock on Sunday, and we've got more information at wypr.org/midday. I'd like to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. They're open for dinner and lunch with breakfast as well, served on the weekends on the web at DizBaltimore.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your calls and your emails. Thanks for subscribing to our podcast and for following us on Twitter. Much appreciated. I'm Tom Hall on behalf of the entire Midday team. Have a great day.